This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, the show where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, I sit down with Jordan Chestnut, Executive Director of the Slo County Arts Council, to talk about the data from the 2025 Arts and Culture Economic Impact Report. It's art, passion, and data all coming together. Then I hand things over to Rosie Boltman, who has a conversation with Christine Dawson from Slo County UndocuSupport, sharing how they're helping longtime local undocumented workers and families. And finally, Mira Honeycutt returns with another edition of Wine Country. She chats with Matt Cleefish of the Ava Hotel in Paso Robles about what drew the Ava to Paso's lush, inviting landscape. Arts advocacy and a little wine country flair. It's all ahead on Issues and Ideas.
Hi, I'm Jordan Chestnut, and I am the Executive Director of Slo County Arts Council.
Jordan, thank you so much for joining us here on Issues and Ideas. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, David. Thanks for having me.
Good. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I'm in my fourth year with Slo County Arts Council. I'm a huge arts lover. I've grown up in the area. I have family members who are all artists, different practices. I've had a background with writing, creative writing. I've lived all around the greater Northwest and moved back here around 2020. And I'm really excited to put my passion to work and with the Arts Council.
What is it about the arts that draws you in?
Let's see. I mean, what I try to do with the arts within this role is situate it in a larger definition. I think a lot of people think about the arts and their initial impulse is to go, okay, painting on a wall, right? And what I want to do is help kind of blow up that definition of the arts itself. That's what I get really excited about, is not just one type of art or art for commercial purposes, but art and creative practice as a way of being. So how do we take art and put it into other sectors, into education, into healthcare, into public policy? All of these things can be a home for the arts, can be a home for creativity. And that's what the Arts Council is here for as well.
Oh, I love that. So you guys are kind of distributing art throughout all facets of Slo County.
Absolutely.
Can you give me a little bit of an example of how you do that?
Okay, so the first way, I think, or the way we do it first and foremost is through advocacy. So I can talk a bit about a report that we just published this past year. It's the 2025 Arts and Culture Economic Impact Report, and it shows the ways that art, specifically the arts and culture sector within the broader creative economy, contributes to, generating money here locally. So with that data, we can advocate for more arts funding on a state level, a city level, regional level, and a state level, and really show the impact, not just within economics, but also in the lives of people and our neighbors, our friends, our family, in the schools, et cetera. So advocacy is one way that we really showcase the value of the arts and promote greater opportunities for artists here. But Slo County Arts Council also has a lot of programs like Open Studios Art Tour, which is coming up this October. Artists open their working studios to the public, and you can go get a sneak preview of the, you know, their practice and their inspiration and their process, and get to know an artist one-on-one in their home environment. We also have Art After Dark. That's one of our most popular programs. Art After Dark takes place primarily in downtown Slo, but it's a countywide program, and it's throughout businesses. Artists can partner with a business and showcase their work in a small exhibition or performance or reading. We also have Poetry Out Loud, which is a student recitation contest for poetry, and Poet Laureate, and many others. So advocacy programs, grant writing, sponsorships, you name it. We really just try to be an infrastructure for the arts as a whole.
Tell me about your Poet Laureate.
So the Poet Laureate program is, it actually had a short hiatus for a while, but It was renewed recently, and we have an amazing poet laureate right now, a friend of mine, actually, or we've become friends in the process, Caleb Nichols. And Caleb has been the poet laureate for about a year, and it was a pretty rigorous nomination and application process. And at this point, you know, when Caleb was first selected as the poet laureate, they said to me, you know, I don't know if I have time for this. I've got a lot on my plate, as most artists do or creative practitioners do. Caleb is an instructor at Cal Poly in the English department and has their own creative writing practice and does a ton of extracurricular stuff as well. And I was like, you know, we're starting kind of from scratch because the program was absent for a couple years through the pandemic. But with that, Caleb has just completely like transformed what I thought was possible and has hosted so many different events. So there's open mics all the time. If you follow Slow Book Bike or Slow County Arts on Instagram, you can see these happening like on a monthly basis. There's talk of a poetry billboard project, so having poems on billboards. There's some public art activities that Caleb is organizing with the city of SLO to bring poetry into the public art realm. So there's a ton of collaborations and events that are happening through this, and it's super organic and really fun to watch.
That's fantastic. What is happening this month?
So this month with October, it's actually National Arts and Humanities Month. So this is a recognition of the importance of culture in America. And it was launched by Americans for the Arts more than 30 years ago as National Arts Week in honor of the 20th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Arts and Endowment for Humanities, which is very pertinent right now since those are two agencies that have been, they're potentially being eliminated right now by the current administration. So it's good to recognize them this month. In 1993, it was established by Americans for the Arts and the National Arts Partners as a month-long celebration of the arts at both a local, state, and national level to really encourage participation in the arts and allow governments and businesses to show their support of the arts and raise public awareness of the positive impact of the arts. So that's National Arts and Humanities Month. And then on a local level within the city of SLO, they have a smaller version of this called Arttober. And that's the city of SLO's way of just kind of echoing back that sentiment.
What can we expect with Arttober?
Within SLO County Arts Council, which is not city of SLO, but countywide, we do have Open Studios Art Tour coming up this month, which is a perfect representation of, you know, the ideas and the inspiration behind National Arts and Humanities Month. So Open Studios Art Tour is on the 11th and 12th and 18th and 19th of October. And if you pick up a catalog or go to our website at slocountyarts.org, you can find artist studios to go visit. And like I said, it's a really great intimate opportunity to get to know an artist and learn about their practice. And it's everything from jewelry making to metalsmithing to ceramics to oil painting. So that's one way that you can show appreciation for the arts and even directly support an artist's career by purchasing from them, maybe a small piece for your home. It is a, you know, it's always a great thing if you can be feeding directly into the local economy. But otherwise with Arttober as a whole, I think the city of SLO is using that as a campaign to just highlight all the different arts and culture organizations here.
And it's not just in SLO, it's all across SLO County, correct?
Well, Arttober is the city of SLO's campaign, but National Arts and Humanities Month, that's nationwide.
Fantastic. And why support local art?
This group that I love based out of Minnesota, which actually has the highest per capita spending on the arts on the state level, so it's highest public spending on the arts. I think it's $10 per person. So Springboard for the Arts, they put it this way. So people want to live and be where they feel welcomed and supported and like they have a role and a sense of pride and community identity and interesting and enjoyable things to do and where they can run into friends. And I think the arts really serves this purpose. So, I mean, we were just talking before the show started about Altadena. And I mean, that's where you hailed from before you came to San Luis or back to San Luis. Mm-hmm. And yeah, art matters in a place because it's a positive feedback loop. And as more people recognize and claim their creative and civic agency, the more they begin to contribute to the community in small and large ways. So that's why, I mean, art really matters. And that message, you know, can be seen and felt oftentimes more than it can be communicated verbally. So it can be clumsy to try to talk about, or it can sound like a cliche. But and the data is there. You know, we have the economic data to support it. But really, you have to go out and you have to be a part of something like Art After Dark and walk around and meet the people and be in dialogue to really feel it and recognize it.
No, you're totally right, because as you were saying, I lived in Southern California for close to 20 years and then moved back in January. And when my family and I first got back, that was kind of the first thing I noticed was the larger impact that art as a whole had on the community. I remember seeing a bigger film festival. When I left, the film festival was cool, but it was a little smaller. And then coming back this year, I was like, it was bigger. The film and the art in the area seemed to explode compared to what I was used to. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's about getting your hands dirty. Get your hands on some chalk. Get your hands on some clay. Mm-hmm. Get behind a camera. Make something. Make art, because it is important, not only personally, but as a community.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that our economic impact report really helped identify. And I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I want to have a quick interjection and say, so Minnesota is $10 of state funding per person, public funding for the arts per person, whereas California, which has so many artists, is 67 cents per person. So we are some of the worst when it comes to public funding available for the arts. When you look at tourism, a lot of people come to California and to San Luis Obispo County because of, you know, our amazing festivals and public art initiatives, things that attract visitors. I think in a report that Visit SoCal just published, tourism in the region achieved a record-breaking $2 billion in direct travel spending in 2022, excuse me. So this is strong growth since the pandemic. And a lot of this is because of, like you said, the Slow Film Fest, Sensorio, the Mid-State Fair, the Paderewski Festival in Paso, Festival Mosaic, and all of these great public art initiatives that we have as well. And these are the things that bring people here. And it also is what keeps people here. I mean, we want to live somewhere where we feel like reflected in like the cultural fabric, and also where there's things to do and like people that you can run into, and there's energy. So, I mean, all of this needs that recognition and support.
That energy is infectious too. So when you're going to a film festival or an Art After Dark, the vibe is infectious. You may just be looking this year, watching a film or looking at art, but maybe the next year you're participating. And isn't that the goal, to get in there and participate one way or another?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, not to be so like attached to the data, but I do have, you know, this to pull from. So something that I love that we found out in the report was that in 2024, in Slo County, an estimated 2,580 volunteers contributed almost 200,000 hours at arts and culture institutions, organizations, and festivals, which is valued at almost $8 million. So to be a part of it can actually, I mean, it has a direct impact or an indirect impact, but it directly benefits the arts organizations. If you're a part of something at the level of a volunteer and actually giving your time, it's a huge contribution. So,
yeah, you're not only learning something, but you're indirectly helping financially as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about where you're getting these numbers from.
Okay, so we worked with a group called Policy Craft Institute based out of Carlsbad, California. And the methodology was to essentially pull from this larger database around 150 organizations, and then we surveyed them with electronic surveys, followed up in person or over the phone to just reach out and make sure our data was correct and accurate and get more input. And then that was compiled into the report. And we also hosted focus groups so that we could get more in-depth and nuanced feedback from people within the sector and in other sectors. So I know it sounds boring. It's pretty dry, but it's actually pretty interesting if you just start to dig into it and talk about it and make it, you know, make it alive. So the report is on our website, slocountyarts.org, and I really recommend people check it out.
I do think that's really neat because I'm a feelings guy. An emotion artist, as most artists are. So we go off of feeling, but it is neat to see that the numbers coincide with the feeling.
Yeah.
You know, there is money coming in. There are people who are interested, and it is on an uptick.
Mm-hmm.
And what is next for Slo County Arts?
Great question. I mean, like I said, this is all coming at a time. We published this report simultaneous to the proposed elimination of the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities and the Institute of Museum and Library Studies. So it was like, oh, wow, okay. Interesting timing. We didn't expect this. So really that advocacy portion is huge right now, and just letting people know that we're here and that we are a supporter of the arts, and we can, you know, keep advocating and keep connecting people and institutions and organizations alike. But also we have a ton of events coming up. So if you are connected to us, besides Art After Dark, there's the others I mentioned.
Where can we find all these upcoming events?
So we have a community calendar on our website, and that's a great place to check out and see what's coming up. We have a pretty active Instagram, a weekly newsletter, so tons of ways to check in with us. And we post a lot of opportunities at the state and regional level as well. So if there's a call for art within the Central Coast, we'll share that. We will have the individual artist fellowships coming up, which is a lot of funding for artists at both emerging to more experienced levels. So that's unrestricted funding as well. You can use it however you want if you're an artist that's selected for this fellowship. That's a really great way to recognize some of the awesome artists that live here. And then we also are looking forward to some new workforce initiatives as well to get, like I said, more creatives out into different sectors and create more professional pathways for artists here in the Central Coast.
Can you give me an example how those pathways work for artists?
Yeah, so something that we were a part of in 2021 to 2023, so Slo County Arts was a part of a multi-county initiative called the Central Coast Creative Corps. And about, 23 different nonprofits, government agencies, and tribal governments. So 23 total of those were selected to receive $140,000 each to fund an artist to partner with them. And that was one way that we could see artists working kind of in these different fields. So some of the artists were working within social service organizations. Here locally, we had Race Matters was funded and Lumina Alliance. So the artists they selected were helping with outreach initiatives, kind of translating some of what they do to different audiences, and also taking, you know, for example, with Lumina Alliance, survivors' stories and unpacking them in creative ways and helping showcase the impacts of domestic violence in a way that made it more accessible and really helped people come together and bond through experiences. So I think in LA, they've actually formalized this more with the LA Cultural Policy Plan. And LA is looking to create jobs within different departments. So within hospitals, for example, having artist practitioners there who can complement some of their other services. And this is one way that we can be really placing artists at the center. And this has been proven to be effective. So according to Californians for the Arts, there's this advocacy concept that artists are second responders, because after a first responder during a natural disaster comes in and saves a life, artists and creative workers step in to help communities heal and rebuild.
Good. Now I want that carved in stone.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because during the pandemic, we were all pushed to the bottom of the list. Artists, that is, you know, we were the last to do anything. So it's nice to at least, I think it's a step in the right direction that we are acknowledged as part of a response team, part of a response to a community.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It's amazing to me how there is this kind of quiet tension where there's artists are so often seen as non-essential, but there is art making is essential. I mean, creativity is essential. Mm-hmm. It's a foundational to our lives and our desire to be somewhere and grow roots and be connected. And when we start to see that become lost or forgotten or dismissed, mm-hmm. and funding is cut, and you know,
it's fundamental to a community. And absolutely. When you start seeing it stripped away, being financially or through a pandemic, you really start to notice how important it really is.
Mm-hmm. And that was a real fear coming out of the pandemic, was will we, especially for the performing arts. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's a huge part of California's, specifically California has such a strong performing arts network and institutions. And I think they were really nervous for a while. But on a local level, we're seeing that be more and more revived through just the slow rep. As an example, the Slow Repertory mm-hmm. Theater is almost completed with building their new facility. So it's exciting, and I hope that people will patron and go to that theater and you know, sign up as members, go to the film fest, see the films,
be a part of it. Exactly. Yeah. That's the point. If be a part of it. Mm-hmm. Put your name out there. Shake some hands. Meet some people. Go see a movie, like you said, that you've never seen before at the film festival. Go on the art tour.
Mm-hmm.
Get lost in some art for a mm-hmm. while. It's so beneficial to your brain and to your heart and to everything else and to your community.
Yeah.
Be a part of it.
Stop doom scrolling.
You heard it here first. Stop doom scrolling, please, and go out and enjoy art.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about the Open Studios Art Tour.
Great. So this is the 27th year. Can you believe that? I'm amazed that it's been going on for that long. So Open Studios Art Tour is, what I love about it is it's truly like the spirit of adventure is baked into the Open Studios Art Tour. You really don't know. Some of these studios are gorgeous, immaculate, professional art studios. And some you really see, like the artist has worked with very limited resources and they've created an amazing body of work despite that. So you have the full spectrum of studios represented, and you have the full spectrum of, you know, visual mediums, everything from, like I said, jewelry making to metalsmithing to pottery. So this is a way that you can tap in, like really just put, like lay your finger down on a map and then go to wherever it lands and explore a studio, meet an artist, have a conversation, buy their work. And it's a very open-ended, completely free community event. So I really encourage people to check it out. I've seen some awesome stuff that some friends of mine have bought as well for not that expensive. So bring some cash, have your wallet. I mean, you'll probably find a piece that you'll keep for the rest of your life or give as a gift. And it's made by somebody who, you know, you'll probably run into again at a grocery store or on a hike somewhere in town.
And that's the beautiful part of living in Slo County, is you do run into those people on the regular. Hey, I bought a piece from you and it's hanging up in my room, mm-hmm. or I gave it to grandma and she loves it. And there's always a story. That story continues. Jordan, please tell me, what is on deck for Slo County Arts?
Great. So this month, like I said, we have October 11th, 12th, 18th, and 19th is the Open Studios Art Tour across the county. Go to our website, slocountyarts.org, to find more information. If you /OSAT, you can see the Open Studios Art Tour webpage with all of the artist studios listed on a digital catalog, testimonials, pictures, workshop dates during those 2 weekends. A lot of them host workshops and live demonstrations. So we have that coming up this month during National Arts and Humanities Month. And then Stay tuned for Poetry Out Loud, which will also take place at the beginning of the new year. And that's also free to the public. Students will recite poetry that they memorize for a countywide competition, and the winner goes on to the state level. That's an awesome event, super inspirational, and that takes place at the beginning of the year. But in the meantime, just keep coming out for Art After Dark, First Friday Art Walk, and enjoy, you know, everything that has to offer.
Jordan, thank you so much for being with us here today on Issues and Ideas, and we'll see you down the road.
Thank you, David.
Hello, I'm Rosie Boltman, and this is Standing in Courage. Standing in Courage explores social justice, activism, and health through conversations with people on the Central Coast. My guest today is Christine Dawson. She's the new CEO of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County. Today, we're talking about one of the foundation's key programs, San Luis Obispo County UndocuSupport. Started in 2020, it provides grants to trusted nonprofit partners working directly with undocumented residents. Welcome, Christine Dawson.
Thank you, Rosie. It's so wonderful to be here today with you. Thank you.
You've just become CEO for the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County. Do you have a background in working with immigrant communities, and what do you hope to bring to SLO County UndocuSupport in your new role?
Thank you. Yes, I'm now 6 weeks in my new role as CEO of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County, and I bring with me over 13 years experience as working as Senior Vice President of Philanthropic Services at the Community Foundation for Monterey County. So we have a long history and experience of working with these various communities throughout Monterey County.
And what specifically does SLO County UndocuSupport do for the immigrant community in San Luis Obispo?
So the UndocuSupport Fund strives to meet the basic needs of immigrant families to allow them to be healthy and thrive. And it seeks to support access to basic health care, social services, and a support that allows families to work, attend school, and care for their children.
What sorts of nonprofits do you partner with in order to make sure that these needs are met?
Yes, we work with various nonprofits around food insecurity, affordable access, barriers to transportation, including for work, school, or healthcare. We also work to ensure that there's access to healthcare and essential medical services, and various nonprofits that work to help with economic hardships, as well as legal assistance for families, especially mixed status families who might be experiencing separation, as well as unaccompanied minors. So we work specifically with the Legal Defense Council Fund.
Wonderful. Do you have any case studies or examples of families that have benefited from the services that SLO County UndocuSupport provides for the community?
Absolutely. So since our founding, which was founded in April 2020, in response to the pandemic, the SLO County UndocuSupport emerged as a collaborative effort among local organizations, community leaders, and concerned individuals responding to urgent needs of immigrant families who were excluded from the federal pandemic relief programs. The fund also supports and connects resources and advocacy with undocumented and other immigrant families in SLO County, aiming to meet basic needs, but also help with other barriers. So since its inception, the fund has distributed over $300,000 and provided support to more than 600 local families across all corners of SLO County. Assistance has included essentials such as rental aid, utility payments, transportation, groceries, and health needs. And as recently as this spring, we distributed awards to organizations like the Immigrant legal defense fund to secure a full-time lawyer focused on SLO County residents to assist with defensive legal services, primarily for asylum seekers, but also, as I mentioned earlier, unaccompanied minors. And they're not only just providing legal representation, but they also provide counseling services, because sometimes these deportation hearings can be very traumatic, especially in these mixed status families.
The Community Foundation estimates that SLO County has between 7,000 and 8,000 undocumented residents. Can you talk a little bit more about who San Luis Obispo's undocumented immigrants are?
Sure, absolutely. So immigrants are integral to the SLO County economy, our culture, and our resilience. So as you mentioned, 10% of our residents are immigrants, and over 80% have lived here for over 15 years. They play critical roles in agriculture, hospitality, and construction. So we are really, they are an integral part of our community. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, this is a moment for courage and compassion and standing with our fellow neighbors and residents.
I want to build on that a bit. Our conversation comes as local immigration enforcement raids on the Central Coast have made national headlines. Can you talk about the circumstances that the local immigrant community is facing right now?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what's happening right now is a lot of potential, cultural isolation that is happening, economic hardship, you know, because of the fear of accessing healthcare, food insecurity, as well as, you know, being able to, access basic services. So that is a big part of why we are concerned for our local community members.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Rosie Boltman talking to CEO of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County, Christine Dawson. And has SLO County UndocuSupport changed in any way its priorities or its actions given recent Trump admission policy and the increased immigration enforcement along the Central Coast?
Absolutely. So some of the key issues facing undocumented or mixed status families in SLO County, of course, is the deportation and separation of families, funding cuts with increased needs for services. Again, I mentioned housing instability or risk of eviction, utility bills, food insecurity, all of those different barriers. But we are really driven by the data. We are also driven by a community. As I mentioned, community leaders make up the UndocuSupport Fund, Advisory Fund. We also act as a role as a convener of a coalition. So we are an organizing entity bringing together immigrant-serving providers to coordinate efforts and more effectively meet the needs of the undocumented and indigenous immigrant families. Through our grants, we support providers delivering these critical aids to these families who often lacked access to many other public resources. And we do this through data, and we also do this through our coalition, where we act as a hub with other partner agencies that serve the families. We've produced an immigrant services guide, and this is open to, and basic needs open to all, regardless of immigration status and more. So there's a lot that we do around coordinating efforts, connecting as a convener, and then also providing resources for providers and families out in the community.
And has there been a different response from the community given recent events, perhaps an increased need for public services or the services that SLO County UndocuSupport provides? How has community need shifted in recent months?
Absolutely. Well, we're meeting now to see how we can address the current needs and the changing landscape. Again, we're meeting next week with our coalition of service providers and others and our other community leaders to learn more how this fund can help and support and some sort of rapid response direct aid. Also, we are launching very soon a volunteer matching, coordination for related volunteer opportunities, matching nonprofits with community members who also want to directly serve and help. And all of this will be located on our website.
Another effect of increased immigration enforcement is the spreading of fear among immigrant and undocumented communities. Has this effect of fear impacted the way that people interact with your services with SLO County UnDocu Support?
Absolutely. And I've just heard recently, actually on an NPR report, nationwide this is happening all over the country. And so fear does play a big part of this. As far as our stance, it's really important on how the public can help. Besides donating to the UnDocu Support Fund, they can also share accurate and trusted information. You can volunteer or attend educational briefings, but it is really important for accurate information to be dispersed to the community.
Your organization seems to function as a resource gatherer and distributor, but has SLO County UnDocu Support advocated in any way for change on the local policy level to protect immigrant communities in San Luis Obispo County?
That's a great question. And so while we are a convener, we are a grant maker, and we also do provide data and needs assessments and resources for families, we are a non-political organization. So as a community foundation, as a nonprofit, we support and lead with our values, but we are non-political as far as that is concerned in our local region.
I now want to talk about how federal policy isn't just affecting immigrant communities, but it's affecting nonprofits as well. Have federal funding cuts impacted the Community Foundation in any way?
That's a great question, and one that we are really digging deep into right now. We've done a needs assessment with our local nonprofits and surveyed over 91 nonprofits in our community throughout the county and learned about the funding cuts, federal, local, state, and county funding cuts, and how this is affecting the critical services, especially those safety net programs. And we are coming together to develop a critical response fund to secure funding and provide funding for these safety net programs throughout our county. We are seeing drastic funding cuts through, the entire region, and especially through those critical safety net services, providing care around homelessness, food insecurity, access to health care, education after school. There's a whole host of issues that we are looking to support.
Are there any specific initiatives that are in the works or being pursued currently under your leadership to perhaps create more security for nonprofits that have previously relied on funding sources that have now proved to be less reliable?
We are getting ready right now to launch our Together for SLO County Fund. And in fact, we are building up a matching pool right now. We're close to over $500,000 raised that will be matched for every dollar given to the fund. Our goal is to fundraise over $1.2 million to give back to the community, addressing, nonprofits addressing these critical needs and safety net programs. So we are just in the beginning phases of putting this together for SLO County Fund together. So more to come, and you should be seeing more of that information coming out shortly.
If people want to donate or contribute to the Community Foundation or to SLO County UnDocu Support specifically, what can you tell people about where their money will be going?
Exactly. So you can go to our website and you'll see directly different ways to give, whether it's our Together for SLO County Fund or our UnDocu Support Fund, and that'll be an easy way to give. Other instructions as well. You can give directly online. You can mail in a check, gifts of cash, stock, or even your required minimum distributions from your individual retirement account. All make great gifts to support our local community through these two initiatives.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Do you have any final thoughts before we go?
Yeah, I just say, you know, now is the time for us all to come together to support our community, to support our neighbors, to lead with our values, really strengthen SLO County, not only donating through these various funds, but also volunteering, supporting your local and favorite nonprofits, providing these critical services, and to share accurate and trusted information. All of these things go a long way. This truly is a moment for courage and compassion, and let's all stand together.
That was Christine Dawson on what SLO County UnDocu Support does for the local immigrant community. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Rosie Boltman, and you're listening to Standing in Courage.
I'm Meera Honeycutt, host of Wine Country. Lately, we've been hearing a lot about the slump in California's wine industry. It's been a tough situation for wine growers and the industry overall. Does this downturn impact wine tourism? Well, some of the numbers I have here today look quite promising for Paso Robles, and they're from a comprehensive study prepared by Beacon Economics and released by Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance in June this year. It says that Paso Robles AVA hosts 2.5 million visitors annually, and the wine industry generates $2.8 billion in total statewide economic output and $2.6 billion within San Luis Obispo County. So is this what drew the new AVA Hotel to Paso Robles? To address that question, I've invited a hospitality industry professional from a new hotel, an impressive addition to downtown Paso Robles. It's the AVA Hotel, part of the Hilton Curio Collection. And my guest is Matt Clayfish, general manager of the hotel. Welcome to Wine Country, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me here. We're excited to chat wine and tourism.
Thank you. So, Matt, you heard these stats I just mentioned. Is this what drew the Hilton management to Paso Robles? How did the project come about?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it actually goes back, to like early 2010s even. I think when Paso was seeing from what people described to me as kind of that additional boom of the wine industry coming to town. And it was the consistency of the performance of hospitality in the Central Coast through San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, that really drew some investment eyes to the region of it having good, consistent performance. And also not necessarily it being a growing region, too. So I think there was growth, stability they saw, stability in the future, and an opportunity for an addition to the downtown hotelscape. So
their eyes on Paso Robles began at that time, 2010.
Yeah, so it goes further back.
I
know what everybody thinks to that they really wanted. They thought that Paso would be great for a project and for a hotel that they didn't want to put a big box building. There's nothing wrong with those, but they didn't want to put a big box building with a big H or a big M on it, like Hilton or Marriott. They wanted to find something that fit into Paso Robles' character.
So describe the Curio Collection process and what it is.
Yeah, so Curio Collection are the type of brand it is in with Hilton, and even Marriott has some of these brands too, and Hyatt, is it allows what they call like a soft or more independent brand while still being associated with a large chain. Mm-hmm. And the goal of these brands, they noticed back probably in the late 90s in the hotel industry, people were putting, remember back in the day when there was a Hilton in town and you had, they had a great restaurant and that was like the best restaurant in town.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And over time now, the best restaurants a lot of times are independent restaurants.
Yeah.
You don't always find that. But that started shifting in the 90s and 2000s a little bit. And what people realized is that to take a concept and force it into a market isn't always the best idea. Sometimes it's better to have a more pliable brand that you can fit into the market that still meets the consumers and the needs of the brands, but has more identity with the local environment. So Curio Collection is an upper upscale version of that for Hilton. The Bella Sara in town, beautiful hotel, is a Tapestry Collection. They are like a full service brand, but a little more economic based. So like Tapestry is kind of a Hilton brand, La Bella Sara Tapestry in town too. Oh. Curio just happens to be the upper upclass version right. for Hilton. And they're kind of that next peg right there. And they're going after a little bit different kind of consumer base, but it allows you to adapt to your region and your locale.
It was a large project. How did you find that spot?
Yeah, and these conversations I know from our great local owners, Brett and Debbie Van Steenwyck, right. who were the original owners of the property. So,
when did the conversation start? The process?
Again, it goes back to, I think in the late 2000s, they were looking at a hotel project in downtown. I don't think they knew exactly what they looked like. The way they describe it to me, and we've had brunch together several times or a glass of wine, and right. so they always shared with me that they wanted a project. They loved Paso Robles. They loved the history of it. They want people to continue enjoying it for years to come. So they wanted a project that fit into that. And I think the hotel, I think they had some other ideas. But so they were looking for the right space for it. So I think they just had an eye on the real estate. The story is that Debbie heard it was available. She called Brett, was like, hey, someone's coming to sign the real estate on this document. And Brett like had to hop on his bike and like pedal downtown from their house. And they got there before and signed the deal. So I think they were on a lookout for a project that would help enhance in the continuation of Paso Robles and the history of it and fit into it and have it be centric and enjoyable for the locals. So I think they had that project in mind, and then over time it develops into what you see today.
Before the groundbreaking, you had to probably apply for permits, etc. So how long did the whole process take? Because you just opened a few months back, right?
Yeah, August 20th was our opening date. So yeah. We're still like in between, just over 30 days of being open for guests. I mean, I've been on the project since December. Azul, the company that has the management contract and been working with the ownerships, have been working with the owners since, I want to say, like 2016, 2017.
Wow.
So they go back a long time. And they'll give advice on we're not construction or development, or we're a professional hospitality company, but we help advise on how do we enhance the guest experience when they're working on the development. So now they make those decisions as the owners and developers, but we give our two cents for really representing the end user, which is the hotel staff and our great guest. So
give us a little bit more details of the hotel. How many rooms? What's the style?
It's large.
It fills two blocks almost?
It really does. Especially with all the food and beverage activations.
Yes, so, and we'll get to that. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
So we have 151 guest rooms. Mm-hmm. I would say it's modern. It's airy, breezy. Spaces flow from one end to the other, meaning like the lobby flows from one space into another, and that's very mm-hmm. intentional. The brickwork on the outside matches a lot of the other buildings in the downtown area. The idea, again, to have a modern expression of Paso Robles and not be a sore thumb, but to be a classy addition to the downtown area.
Yeah, it kind of fits in.
Yeah, it's actually the same footprint, I believe, as Hotel San Luis Obispo as far as like the building square footage. We have more parking in our area, but they just did a really good job of maximizing the space and the guest rooms to get a little bit higher guest count, because we have three different food and beverage concepts. It was important to try to get as many guests in the building as possible and make it accessible to people who are walking around downtown. I mean, adding the retail shops on Pine Street, which are now starting construction here over the next month, it'll be a great kind of walkable addition to the downtown area.
Tell us about the various dining options that we just talked about. How many different restaurants and what kind of cuisine they're offering?
Yeah, so we were blessed to have several really great local business people involved in the project, one being Eric Jensen, who founded Booker and My Favorite Neighbor. So Eric's part of the team. Azul has a lot of that background, but I think, Eric's relationship with Stefan and La Ventour and Julian, with having Le Petit Canai and Serenea, there was a connection there. So we have partnered with kind of local celebrity chefs, people who are passionate, people who are on the cutting edge and adventurous, all the things that describe Julian, as I'm sure you've met him. He's an awesome guy. So we are lucky to partner with him. And since we really wanted to do a great Mediterranean concept, what better than to find someone who's lived in France and cooked in France and cooked and lived in Spain and has eaten in North Africa, which is, you know, some of the spices and flavors we have in Emre. So we were really lucky to partner with Julian. And then we got Casey McMinn, who had worked for Bon Appetit. He worked for The Hatch. We got Nate Lopez, who has a great history. So we certainly have some culinary firepower and are blessed to be so. But the feature is Emre, which is E-M-R-E.
What does it stand for?
It means like fire and passion. It also is the, you know, it's a nod to the ancient Anatolia. So not just a specific country that exists now, but kind of the Anatolian area at the time. And so the concept of Mediterranean was we didn't – I love Italian food, but we didn't want to just be Italian food or just, you know, Greek food. So we wanted to – Emre kind of came, I think, from one, they wanted a beautiful – we have a beautiful fire, like Grill Works, custom grill, Santa Maria style, that we have live wood cooking inside the kitchen in the building. So something that was fire, something you would do with friends. We have Italian food, Greek food. We have some North African spice and some different concepts. We're going to have a lot of fresh fish and vegetables and using the Central Coast bounty, but having the Mediterranean. Right. So that concept board. And then, of course, that pairs with great wine. So in Emre now we have an opening date. It'll be
October
29th, maybe October 30th.
If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. Today my guest is Matt Clayfish, general manager of the new Ava Hotel, part of the Hilton Curio Collection in Paso Robles. Tell us, your rooftop bar is quite a hangout now, isn't it?
It's
so tell me about that.
It's a vibe. It's
an experience. Yeah.
It's an experience up there. Esperanza is the name. So our rooftop is divided into these sections. We have a beautiful saltwater pool. We have a little event space. We have maybe 100. We're actually adding 3 tables as we speak. Because it's at capacity quite often in the evening, so we want to make sure we have some space. And we don't want it to be crowded, but we do want to try to take more guests who are coming. It's Baja-inspired, so Esperanza. We wanted it to be, when we talked about that space with our team, as a kind of a feminine space and bold. And we wanted like a, you know, kind of like a strong salsa dancer, this feminine vibe, and the food's really good, and there's music, and we input a lot of botanicals, as you've seen. So there's these beautiful different botanicals that kind of soften and add some warmth to the space. We're installing heaters actually next week. So it's a beautiful spot.
You have a great cocktail list there, I noticed. And you've got some great cocktail makers. You know, they're shaking, they're dancing. I mean, there's quite a scene going on. Is there a signature Ava cocktail?
There is. I mean, I think, you know, there's fan favorites, our regulars' favorites
right
now, like Lulumbra, which is kind of like a spicy margarita that it's crazy now. These bartenders are so much talented.
Very
they're almost
talented.
Like chefs. It's like they're like chemists and, you know, microbiologists. And they're getting so talented now that they're surpassing my knowledge, certainly by far. They're adding acids and doing things. They're basically like a culinary team.
Really? And I like the idea of botanicals. You've got all these different botanicals in these cocktail mixes. Yeah.
Yeah. They've become really culinarians, the bartenders. So great cocktails. I like the Ava Margarita. There's a sea salt foam that goes on it. I like a classic. Spirit forward cocktail that's well balanced.
I see the wine list looks pretty good. Let's talk first about some of the local wines you're going to carry or you carry.
Yeah, so one cool thing, we have Emre, which opens late October. We have Esperanza on the rooftop, and then we have Pine Street Bistro. The cool thing about the list in your hands that we worked really hard with Lanin to do is this list is available at every outlet. So our full wine list is available across the property. So if you find yourself in our lobby bistro sitting by a fireplace, you can get the same
any of these
wines. It might take us a minute to run in the back and get it for you, but we wanted to make although we have a different kind of by the glass list that's smaller, you can always request or we will serve the full master list of wine.
How big is your cellar? I mean, do you have a number or?
Yeah, well, we wanted to be around 200 SKUs, which I know isn't earth shattering for some of the great wineries. I was at like Nova the other day and they were telling me they had like closer to like 1,000 wines or something.
I know,
which I would love to. Le Petit Canaille has like 1,000 wines.
Oh yeah, I've been to that cellar. Yeah,
with Alex. So we unfortunately don't have a cellar that large. We're we're about 100 and just under 150 right now is SKUs.
But the list looks amazing. I mean, it's so well balanced. It's your local California wines, Central Coast wines, and of course European wines. What are some of the locals? I see you've got Booker on your list, Love and Tour, Denner, McPrice. I mean, you've got a very good list here.
The wine out here, it's like not what local winery do you partner with. Unfortunately, it's like how do you, not partner with so many of them because there's so many options.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
really the hardest thing. When we started off the project, we talked to Julian Aseo, and Alex, and we talked to Eric Jensen of Booker, and we said, all right, where are we going to be? And what we found is people who are coming here to Paso Robles who are in the hotel, a lot of them are going to want to drink our Central Coast wine, which are blessed to have a lot. And then a lot of the people who live here are maybe coming from Napa or Paso or San Luis Obispo. A lot of times they taste a lot of the Paso wine and they want to taste some international wine.
So absolutely, yes.
We went into this being like, we think we're going to be 70% international. And, like any plan, it doesn't survive battle. But as we went and started partnering with some of the Central Coast wineries and Paso Robles wineries, we were just like blown away. And so they were more 50-50. We kind of ended up a little split. But yeah, you mentioned some great wineries on there. My favorite winery right now, just like from tasting the wine, is Claude Solène. I know that we're not supposed to have favorites, but so there's some Claude Solène on there.
Yeah.
Of course, there's Sador wineries on there, Larat, which is kind of a lesser known winery run by Charles Liu. And there's just so many. But yeah, La Vontour, Booker, my favorite neighbor.
Yes.
Denner, Bodega de Edgar, the Albarino on the rooftop.
Yes.
That thing is like full speed ahead. Field recordings we have on tap on the rooftop. So we have their Sangio up there.
Okay.
I think it's the Freddo is the brand. And so we actually have that on a wine tap at Esperanza. That sells extremely well.
But you've got a great Burgundy list here. Man, yeah. So the most expensive bottle here I see would be, what, about 650, then 450. But this is, and then you've got very affordable prices. An Aglianico at $56 a bottle. Nero Diavolo from Clessi. They make very good Italian. They specialize in Italian. And you've got Priorat wines. You've got Brunello's, Nebbiolo. I mean, you've got some very good international and local wine list. You were bold enough to come with this large hotel. And recognizing that even though the industry is like in doldrums, as they say, the tourism is still there, right?
Absolutely. The tourism is totally there. I worked in the Texas wine industry, which I know people kind of giggle at a little bit potentially. The tourism is 100% there. Is the growth as astronomical as it was maybe during kind of COVID when drive-in markets, really, I think you saw this huge bump of drive-in business in these markets and people wanting to travel and spend locally. So I don't think we're seeing that growth right now. So maybe we're a little bit of a, I think these like doldrums are a little bit of a victim of our own success, but I think there's still consistent growth. I really love working with people in Paso. When I took this job to come out here, this was on a short list of places I would want to be in. And of a lot of it is just the community in Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo is very welcoming and friendly. Being a professional in my industry, I want to work at places that we have awesome guests and awesome community. So that was attractive, I think, to me. And the reason I say that about the tourism is what I see, and I talk to a lot of guests and groups, is that's why they come to Paso. Yes, we have a great wine region, but they also love the personality that is being developed in the Central Coast and the persona that we adopt as being welcoming and friendly. So, and I've worked, like I said, in Temecula, and I've worked in the Texas wine region, and I visited in the Napa region. So I think Paso's done a good job, whether intentionally or unintentionally, kind of branding itself as like this open arms, very friendly.
So true.
And that is as important as all the great wine we have, because a winery, always tastes better with great friends and people like to be around.
It's all about the people. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
You were listening to Matt Clayfish, General Manager of the Ava Hotel in Paso Robles. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Meera Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAbee. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.